Good evening and welcome to another edition of Midwest Beats. I'm Tom Lounge as your host. This program is all about music and the people who make it. Tonight we are paying tribute to a man who has made music for many, many decades, a man whose art touched us all and who changed the face of not only music, but visual arts and fashion, the one and only David Bowie. We're going to focus on David Bowie's life, some of his music, and I have excerpts some great quotes from my interview with David over the years. So we're going to feature some of that as we remember the late great chameleon of rock and roll, the Thin White Duke, David Bowie. After your headlines here. Midwest Beat with Tom Lounges is made possible by Merrillville's Broadway Glass and Customs, providing auto, commercial, and residential glass replacement for more than 15 years. 219-88-GLASS or broadwayglass.net. Good evening and welcome to another edition of Midwest Beat. I'm Tom Lounge as your host, and tonight we pay tribute to the late great David Bowie, who shuffled off this mortal coil on Sunday. The news came and woke up the world on Monday, shocking so many rock and roll fans, not even aware that David had been sick. Tonight we're going to excerpt my last interview with David, which was in 2004, and we're going to play some sound bites from that. And my path crossed with David's. His first time was in 1979. It was the first time I had a chance to interview him. I was invited by RCA Records to a private listening party for the Lodger album, and David showed up at the hotel suite. It was an interesting situation, to say the least. He walked in, and the room stopped. You could have heard a pin drop. That was the first time I had a chance to say hello to David. I saw him again when two friends took me as a surprise in 1980 to see him in The Elephant Man. In fact, it was the night that John Lennon was shot and killed. A very memorable evening, to say the least. 1987, I had a chance to see him on the Glass Spider tour with, of course, Stevie Ray Vaughan on guitar, and what a great tour that was. And then the reality tour in 2004, from which the interview was done, that we'll be excerpting tonight. David left us in his golden years, and that's why we opened with that song. The news came on Monday morning that David Bowie was dead at the age of 69, just 2 days after his birthday, just 2 days after the release of his newest album, an album called Black Star. The opening line of the first single, Lazarus, from this album says, "Look up here, I'm in heaven." And it's kind of a disturbing prophetic album. Tony Visconti, David's longtime producer, and we will address his thoughts on Tony during the course of tonight's show. Tony Visconti described it as his farewell to his fans. Tony said his death was like his life, a work of art. So let's open up the show with his latest single and listen to that first line and see if it doesn't give you goosebumps as he says, "Look up here, I'm in heaven." It's David Bowie.
Scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now. Cell phone down below. Ain't that just like me?
The latest single, the last single from David Bowie, released on his birthday, January 8th, along with his newest album, latest album, last album, Black Star. The video, which you've probably seen if you've been watching the news for Lazarus, is disturbing, and it's creative. You got to give the man credit for embracing his fate. It's going to be viewed by so many different people, so many different ways. It features the musician, David Bowie, in a hospital bed with bandages on, and it finishes with him retreating into a dark closet as though saying goodbye. And according to his producer on Black Star, Tony Visconti, his longtime friend and producer, David planned it this way, that they recorded this album in three sessions over 2015. He was an artist, and he did things his way. The fact that he embraced his mortality as he did says something, you know, for all of us as far as, you know, going with dignity.
It does. And it's, you know, what else? Like you were saying, I don't think a lot of people knew that he was sick with cancer.
Nobody did except the immediate family and circle of friends. He
came
kept
as
it a secret.
Complete shock. David Bowie's dead. I couldn't believe it. 2 days after his album release is when he passed away. And I think 2 days after his 69th birthday, too.
Right. So. January 8th. He shared a birthday with Elvis.
That's right. Day. Wow.
We're going to play some excerpts from the 2004 interview I did with David. He was full of life and very excited to be on the reality tour that was coming back to America. He played at the Rosemont Theater, did three shows there, all sold out. And I spoke with David, and I remember asking him if there was one or two artists who specifically influenced him early on in life. And this is what David said.
No, that's probably the problem. It wasn't really one art. I mean, there's one that set it aflame, and that was Little Richard way back when I was 9. But in terms of when I was a little more serious about the work and when I was starting to write, I was listening to everything I could get my hands on. I was influenced from everybody, from Little Richard, Charlie Mingus, Jacques Brel, to Velvet Underground. I mean, it was so wide, the net that I cast as a listener and as a fan, you know.
You know, it was interesting because Little Richard was another one of those that march to his own drum, so to speak,
sure.
Or piano pounding in this case.
Right. Yeah.
And that he was such an influence on David at 9 years old. But like he said, so many different people over the years, you hear the jazz, you hear the minimalist, you hear so much in his music over the years. Bowie's sound went from folk music in the 60s, like everybody else was doing with the first album, on up through the Berlin Trilogy albums of minimalist sparseness. It, just amazing, you know, the glitter rock thing, everything that he embraced.
It really is. And very few artists, I think, truly change over time like that. Like the Beatles, through their span, every album was different. Kind of like Bowie. He went through his different phases and just kept relevant.
Well, there was a time when he was putting out two albums a year, like all the other artists back then. And this album, Black Star, his latest album, is his 25th. And
wow.
You know, the thing about David Bowie is he was so against being pigeonholed. And I asked him about that in that interview. I said, David, you're known for changing your sets around from night to night on many of the tours, kind of like the Grateful Dead had done. You'd go and see him one night, and the next night's a completely different set. Some nights, his shows would run longer than others, depending on his mood, depending how many songs he wanted to play. And so I asked him about this and his penchant for doing that as far as changing his sets around and moving the songs. And this is what he had to say.
We put together a kind of a skeletal set, and then I can leap and jump throughout the set, but at least we've got something we know has a structure to come back to if if I do too many ballads in a row or something like that, I can jump back into the pre-prepared one. It changes radically, depending on the energy and how many shows we've done back to back and all that. I think generally though, I'd say the average show is about 24 songs, but we haven't got the kind of length of repertoire learnt under our belts like, say, Dylan, who's been doing his tour since 1988, I think. That's one hell of a tour. And I think he's built a repertoire of something like 100. I think his sound man told me they've got like 150 songs to choose from. I've got about 50 songs, so it's quite good. You know, 50-song pot is pretty good to pick and choose from.
Indeed it is. 50 songs at your beck and call.
That's a lot.
That you know.
It's a lot of music to learn and know, that's for sure.
As I said, David Bowie's career spanned such an expanse of sounds, and he did so much. Last year at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, there's a big exhibit. In fact, it was the only stop in the U.S. of this traveling museum tour, and it showed the depth of his artistic impact, not just on music, but in visual arts, in video, in film, in theater, as I mentioned with the Elephant Man that we'll talk about a little later, and in fashion. He was always breaking new boundaries. And, they said he was an alien, and I sometimes believe it.
From outer space.
He's the man who fell to Earth.
Yeah, he kind of was.
He's the star man. Let's go to the album that this interview was from. Again, in 2003, he recorded Reality. In 2004, that tour brought him to the Rosemont Theater. And this was the single from it. In fact, it was the favorite Bowie song for a long time, maybe still is, of an old friend of mine, Hegwisch Lisa. So we're going to dedicate this to her. New Killer Star from Reality. That's a single off Reality, New Killer Star. That came out 2004. The album was cut in 2003. I remember seeing him on that tour. We've been talking about the impact David Bowie has had on not only music, but visual arts and fashion. And one of the other things that he really has helped was to break down a lot of stereotypes. I've got a special guest on the phone with us right now, East Chicago's very own rock and roll legend, Mr. Jim Scafish. Jimmy, are you there?
I am here, Tom, and thank you for having me.
You know, you are in so many ways like David Bowie. You've broken so many barriers. You've never been afraid to step forward and exercise your thoughts for the sake of art. One of the things that David did during especially the glam period, the Ziggy days, was break down sexual stereotypes. He made it okay to be different. And you were part of that scene at that time. And you yourself have some history of being different. So what's your take on David? I know you were a big fan.
Well, I think one of the things is that we have to keep in perspective the difference between then and now, because time will always put something in context. And at the time when David came out, and there is still some degree of this in, quote, rock music, especially with male performers, that it was a very kind of a macho, hetero kind of a thing. You know, even if the guy had, like, girl's hair or makeup, there was still this sense of this kind of macho kind of thing. And what David did is by openly admitting that he was bisexual and dressing in ways that was gender-bending and androgynous, he really put it out there in a way that was real. In other words, it wasn't just like, say, you'd look at him and say, oh, this guy's weird, but he has a girlfriend and he drinks beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was really putting it out there in a way that was revolutionary. And it was also, I think, fair to say that it was in the air at that time in terms of sort of a cosmic social revolution, even if you think of other people like the New York Dolls and Jane County, you know, who came around that time as well. And I think that David's impact was immeasurable. And I think even if you look at an artist like Lady Gaga, has a great debt to David, as well as the artists of today. But I think especially now, where in popular culture, being queer or being weird is considered sort of boguish, especially for females, not as much for males. It's still somewhat stigmatized with guys, but not as much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that David was really a leader in trying to do that. And certainly I tried to be a leader as well in that as well, in a slightly different way, because I was presenting a much more non-glamorous image, a much more tormented image, if you will, of gender confusion and sexual revolution, as opposed to just trying to present the sort of pretty space age side of it, which David did immeasurably well. And I think the thing about David that was so great is that I would make the argument, and I'm not sure that I've ever heard anybody make this argument yet, that he had much more of an influence on the beginning of punk than people would think.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though punk was sort of supposed to be the stripped-down sort of thing, and David was very glamorous and bigger than life, that I think the fact that he brought misfits together, in other words, David spoke to outcasts throughout the entire world at that time in a way that I don't think any other rock artist, for sure, or pop rock artist was able to do. One could make the argument for Alice Cooper or Kiss, but I think that their sense was much more mainstream, for lack of a better word.
Okay.
In other words, the difference between a guy who looks like a superhero or somebody who's, you know, a villain versus a guy who could be, you know, gay or straight, in a dress, wearing girls' clothes, there's a difference there. And I think that even though people may not see those differences and just think, you know, Kiss, Alice Cooper, David Bowie, same thing, I think they're very different in the sense that Alice and Kiss, I think, were much more acceptable and they could appeal more to the beer-drinking guy, you know,
mm-hmm.
the guy who's going to get in a fight and go to the strip club, where David really pushed that a lot further. And so I think that, you know, his influence on the beginning of punk, I think, is important as well because he brought misfits together, and especially in the early punk movement, which obviously I was there, that there was a sense of misfits uniting. It was a sense of not just rebellion, but also a sense of outcast. So I think that David was instrumental in helping to pioneer that as well. And of course, the New Romantic movement and the gender bending and all the things that he did, you know, are immeasurable. But what I really think was great is that I really became turned on to him with his Ziggy Stardust phase. And I would say that was really my favorite phase of his career. I really liked the rock music he did, the rawness, his band. I really liked the fact that there was a real edge to those performances. And, and of course, I love everything that he did. And his last album is just amazing in terms of jazz exploration and the atmospheric quality of it and sort of the eeriness of it, if you will.
Well, he mentioned...
This would turn me on to him. Go ahead, I'm listening.
He mentioned that Mingus was a big influence, as well as the Velvet Underground and Miles Davis. And it's interesting you mentioned the jazz aspects of the latter-day stuff, including this last album, because a lot of people think of David Bowie as the rock and roller, you know, the chameleon of rock.
Right.
But he was so steeped in so many different... styles of music, like yourself. I mean, your sound, in many ways, has mirrored his. You started off with the hardcore punk sound and the Sign of the Cross and things like that, but you later on went into Who is James or Where is James Bond, which was much different in its scope. And, of course, you play classical. You've done so many different styles of music very much. That's why I like to sometimes compare you to him of our local scene, because you have dared to... What has been successful for you, you don't stay there. You raise the bar higher. And I think that was something that he did, especially with bands like Tin Machine and some of the more avant-garde things that he did, where he knew it wasn't going to sell, but he did it anyway. He had the artist's soul.
Well, and first off, even to be mentioned, you know, in the same sentence as David is obviously a tremendous, you know, honor. I mean, I've loved the things that David has done and really have respected what he's done. But I think one of the things that I think David was very good at, and I think that time shows this in a more clear way, is I would make the argument that the pop artists of today, musically, are very, very formulaic. Even a person like, say, if you look at, again, at Lady Gaga, whose image was very out there and a sense derivative of Klaus Nomi and David Bowie and Grace Jones and people like that, that her pop music has been very formulaic, in my opinion. Where I think where somebody like David, you know, walked a fine line between certain things that were very avant-garde that would never sell, and he was also very capable of crass commercialism, which I would bet he would fully, openly admit.
I do remember him telling me that in an interview. I don't think I have it on one of the clips tonight, but he did mention, he was talking about commercialism. He goes, there's nothing wrong with commercialism and success, but you shouldn't strive for that only. It shouldn't dictate your art.
Yeah, and I think what he did is I think he was able to do both in a way that I think a lot of the artists of today are having a harder time with, because the idea that even the sense of what one could quote-unquote get away with musically back then and still sell records, in my opinion, and I think most people would agree with me, was more open-ended. In other words, you could have a group like Weather Report, say, in the early 70s, who could actually make a living doing music. Could that same group make a living today? I would argue probably not, or certainly not a reasonable living, or John McLaughlin, or Chick Corea, or people like that, in that sort of jazz fusion-y kind of a thing. And, of course, some of those artists have continued to have successful careers, namely Chick Corea, of course. But I think that with David, I think that he was able to wear so many hats and do them so well. But I think that with David, he was openly acknowledging that he did these things as a collector. He did these things as, you know, this is what he's picking up or sampling this or sampling that. Not sampling a music track, but sampling personalities. But I think that with his jazz influence, especially with this last record, I think was very profound, because the thing about the jazz influence, obviously something that I've been a part of, jazz and classical and all those different kind of styles too, is that when, you know, something is that important to you, and obviously it was very important to him, it helped to define his entire life, that he was going to explore. And what I admire about him so much is that, granted, he was able to sell, you know, 130 million records, and he had a good business sense, but he really did push the envelope over and over and over again as an artist, as a fashion icon, in sexuality, and in business as well. I think he's just, his contribution is immeasurable.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this late, great rock and roller and musician and fashion icon and a guy that definitely touched so many people with his life.
Oh, absolutely, and I think he will continue to. And I think especially now with the immediacy and the depth of the internet, that there are going to be people remembering him from here on out. He's not going to just have a moment where people remember him and he'll fade. He will really last. And listen, thank you for including me to everybody out there. I wish everybody a great new year, and thanks for talking to me.
All right. We're going to send this one out to you, Jim. It's the song you mentioned inspired you. This is Ziggy Stardust, David Bowie. We'll talk more with, we'll talk more with the late, great David Bowie after this.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang. Screwed up eyes and screw down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan. Jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass. He was the Naz with God-given ass. He took it all too far, but boy, could he play guitar. Making love with his ego, Ziggy sucked up in two.
Stardust, the Spiders from Mars, a guy with screwed up eyes and a screwed down hairdo. What a great album that was. Timeless.
It really was, and an amazing character too.
Yeah, Mick Ronson, a great guitar player. The Spiders were such a phenomenal band, and David went on to say that the bands that he did in the 90s and the 2000s were the best bands ever, but you gotta salute the Spiders. They were awesome. Thanks to Jim Scafers for joining us and sharing a little personal insight from the rock and roll perspective. Jim, of course, signed with IRS Records back in the day, toured with the Police, was in Urga Music War, worked with Midge Ultravox, all these great talents. Jim is one of ours from right here in Northwest Indiana. And we're very proud of him. And again, like Bowie, he did the androgynous thing. He broke barriers, and he's still going, still doing well. In fact, we're going to have him back on to talk about that part of his career very soon. Again, Ziggy Stardust, one of the biggest hits, one of the songs David's best known for. And in the 1990s, Bowie said he was done with all that. He was done with Ziggy. He was done with all the old hits, the golden years, everything. And that he wouldn't be playing any of those old songs from his catalog, only the more recent releases that he was doing in the 90s. And he stuck to that for a while. He did a couple of tours and didn't play any of the old songs from his catalog. But after a while, some of those classic songs began popping up in his shows again and returning to his hits list. I asked him what brought out the change of heart and what the ratio was as far as picking the old ones versus the new ones and things like that. And again, this was in 2004, and he had just started slipping them back in again shortly before that. And this is what David had to say about slipping those new songs or those old songs back in.
Yeah, I generally get a whole bunch from the 90s, and then some from the 80s and some from the 70s. I haven't yet done any from the 60s. The best thing about doing them again is doing them again. I mean, when you've not done them for quite some time, I think you have a visceral thrill about doing them. It feels pretty new again. But I think that, for me, there was a quite strong rationale for not doing them for a few years there, is that I really wanted to give my new songwriting a chance. And now that I feel pretty, you know, happy about the way things have gone for me as a songwriter, I feel that the newer things are quite as strong as a lot of the old stuff. So I don't think that, you know, I don't find the old things as intimidating as I probably felt they were in the early 90s when I was trying to find out which way I was going to be going.
All right, in the 1990s, he was experimenting with so many great albums, and one of the things that David did that shocked his fans and shocked the music business, and I'm sure shocked his record label, was he stopped performing as a solo artist. He stopped recording as David Bowie, stopped touring completely as David Bowie, and put together a group called The Tin Machine back in 1990.
Tin Machine, Tin Machine, take me anywhere. Tin machine, the zombies never pass. The kind that beats his baby up, the preachers and their ass.
Tin machine. Definitely a lot different than the music we were familiar with from David Bowie that featured a great guitarist, Reeves Gabrials. The lineup was completed by Tony and Hunt Sales. And Bowie had known all these guys since the 70s, and they contributed to a lot of different albums, including some of Iggy Pop stuff like Lust for Life. So he put Tin Machine together. They did two albums. The first one, not so bad. The second one, Tin Machine 2, kind of failed miserably. And when the fans failed to embrace the Tin Machine project, and especially the second album that came out, it became the lowest charting album in the history of David Bowie's career, also the poorest selling. So when I had David on the phone, I asked him, why did you choose to do Tin Machine? I mean, not that it was a bad project, but coming from where he had been, Tin Machine was definitely different. And the fact that it failed to ignite the fans, was he disappointed that the fans didn't support it? And David, being the true artist that he is, gave us this answer.
It was a very selfish thing, and it was really very much just for me. I really needed to do something that helped me find a direction again that I felt enthusiastic about. And for me personally, it was one of the best things I did. And I don't think I could have done a better thing to save my own sense of who I was as a musician and as a songwriter. And I think that I came out of it a much better artist and writer. I didn't find any disappointment in the project at all.
I thought that was an interesting expression there, Dan, that he said, well, it was a selfish thing that I did, but I needed to do it to kind of recharge his batteries.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially with someone with his artistry and the way he has gone about his career. Just it's not selfish, but the music and all that he creates comes because he wants to portray that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not going to let commercial interests
dictate what he does.
Yeah, stop him from doing what he wants to do.
And I stand behind what I said earlier. I thought the first Tin Machine album was pretty good. I think it was a nice experiment, but I think pushing it to a second album, Tin Machine 2, was kind of overkill. And it just didn't do well. It was ill-timed. Production was weird on it. He was with a new record label, Victory, which was a little step above indie. They just didn't seem to grasp what to do with it. I don't think he knew what to do with it. The fans didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And Tin Machine 2 was an experiment that didn't really do well, although they did put a live album
out.
Didn't hurt his career much, though. It didn't. Nothing could hurt. He was Teflon, man. Yeah. David Bowie was Teflon. He could do just about anything. In fact, talking about the different phases of his career, we talked with Jim Scafish about the glitter glam years. We talked that he started out as a folk singer. We talked a little bit about the minimalist years with Brian Eno, the Berlin Sessions, as they were called. I asked David, I said, you know, you've been through so many phases, so many different styles, so many hits, so many non-hits. Look back, David, is what I said, and tell us of the various periods of your career and the many albums. What might you cite as personal highlights from your career thus far in 2004? And this is what he said.
Oh, dear, I'm not sure I do that too often. I don't know. I really don't know. I like bits and pieces of a lot of periods that I've done. Gee, that's difficult to say. I was very pleased the way that the Heathen album went with Tony Visconti, in as much it really gave us room for further work. Once we completed the project, I think we both really felt that we still had a very strong future as a collaboration creatively, you know. So that was pretty fulfilling in that way. I'm pretty pleased with most of the stuff I did in the 90s, actually. I feel really good about those things. I look back on those things, all of them, with a lot of fondness.
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
Yeah, I pretty much like the 90s.
Trying to pick his favorites there. He loved the 90s stuff, probably the least selling of his albums, but it was what he liked, it's what he chose, and it's what he was most proud of. Albums like Black Tie, White Noise, The Buddha of Suburbia, Never Let Me Down, which was the tail end of the 80s, the Earthling album, 1997. Heathen, of course, was a big album for him in 2002. I know that was one that meant a lot to him as well. In fact, Heathen was the album that actually reunited him with his longtime producer, Tony Visconti. Tony had been instrumental in creating the David Bowie sound, along with David and the Spiders back in the day. And even though they had made some incredible records together early on, they separated, as creative people often do, only to reunite successfully for the Heathen album, which came out in 2002. If his relationship with Visconti had not come back, David might not have made the albums he did that he was so proud of in the 1990s. So I asked him, what enticed the reformation, the reuniting, both personally and professionally, of their relationship, his and Tony Visconti's? And this is what David said.
We'd actually sort of gotten friendly again about midway through the 90s, quite early on. But the opportunity to do something together in the studio hadn't really risen until the period that we did go in. It was just seemed a natural kind of thing, you know. Tony had moved back to New York again because he'd kind of left London. He'd lived in London an awful lot of his life. And we kind of just kept running into each other in New York, and it was a natural response to renewing that friendship that we would, you know, try again in the studio and see what happened.
And, of course, he stayed with Tony Visconti up until his final album, Black Star, which came out January 8th, his last album. So the reunion between David Bowie and Tony Visconti yielded some incredible albums, including the Reality album that we're going to feature in just a moment here. And on that album, David Bowie covered a George Harrison song called Try Some, Buy Some. And I thought, what a nice way for him to pay tribute to the fallen Beatle, who himself had just passed away. And when I asked him about the tribute to George, David said this.
Well, yeah, it didn't register with me as a George Harrison song initially. I bought it in 1974 as a single by Ronnie Spector on the Apple label. And as a single, it's been one of my favorite singles for many, many years. I just wanted to do the song, and it only really occurred to me when we were writing the credits out that, in fact, it was a George Harrison song, and that in a strange kind of way, it was almost a tribute to George, kind of an unwitting tribute. I'm very, very pleased it kind of worked out like that. But it wasn't an intention to do a George Harrison song per se. It was really because I really liked the Ronnie Spector version. I'm a big fan of hers. She would be somebody wonderful to work with. That's an interesting prospect, isn't it?
It certainly is. I wish that would have happened. Ronnie Spector and David Bowie, two of my favorite people. I've had a chance to work with both over the years, and to see that mashup would have been great in the studio. But of course, we didn't. We've been talking about the Try Some, Buy Some song that he bought because he was a fan of Ronnie. We're going to go back to 2004, the Reality album, and Try Some, Buy Some.
We're back in time. Someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some. I bought some. Ooh. After a while, when I had tried them, denied them, I opened my eyes and I saw you. Not a thing did I have. Not a thing did I see till I called on your love, and your love came to me. Oh, 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 oh. I've seen grey sky, met big fry, seen them die to get high. Oh, oh. When it seemed that I would only be lonely, I opened my eyes and I saw you. Not a thing did I feel. Not a thing did I know till I called on your love, and your love sure did grow.
Try Some, Buy Some, a George Harrison written song that David Bowie fell in love with when he heard the single as covered by Ronnie Spector, who interestingly enough actually toured as a member of the Ronettes with the Beatles back in the 1960s. And Bowie fell in love with that song and didn't even realize it was a George Harrison song until he started doing the credits on the album. So it's kind of cool, as he said, that it turned out that way. David Bowie had a fair share of films and even some television credits under his belt. Some great movies like The Man Who Fell to Earth, of course, Labyrinth with Jennifer Connelly, and The Hunger, Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence was an amazing film as well. He was the Japanese World War II concentration camp. And all of these were art films that embedded themselves in the rock scene, and the critics loved them. So I asked David, at this point in 2004, he hadn't done much on camera. And I said, David, do you have any plans to do any more acting? And I also asked him if acting was satisfying to him creatively. I was actually quite surprised, given the success of his films and given the popularity with his fans of the films, that he gave this answer.
Not if I can help it. No, I'm not doing anything like that. No filming, no nothing like that. I don't really have any ambitions in that area at all. I think there's too much hard work attached to it, and I don't have the commitment. I don't have the commitment to be an actor. Having a lot of willpower about taking it seriously and studying and I guess doing all those rounds and going to do auditions. I just don't have the commitment to be an actor like that, you know. I would do that for the music, and I have done in the past. I've walked the streets for music, but I certainly wouldn't do it for acting. So for me, it's been left to, you know, if somebody offers me some great little walk-on part or cameo thing, and it's a real interesting director to work with, and it's generally how it's happened for me. I just like the writing and the performing at the moment. And my family life, you know, that's pretty much all I need.
I was very shocked to hear him say that he didn't enjoy acting as much or embrace it. But I love the fact that when he said he would take it to the streets for music, that he had and he would again, because he certainly did with the albums he did in the 1990s and the 2000s. I mentioned earlier in the beginning that the evening that John Lennon was slain back in 1980, I was in Chicago with a few friends who had surprised me with tickets to go see Bowie in The Elephant Man at the then Blackstone Theater in Chicago. That performance was one of the best things I'd ever seen on stage before or since. David's way of making the audience see him as the ill-fated John Merrick, without any special makeup, costuming, or effects, by simply twisting and contorting his body and face, was absolutely amazing. So of that experience that was so moving for me to see David Bowie in The Elephant Man, I asked him what his thoughts were of portraying John Merrick and doing that play, and here's what he said.
It was just the most wonderful thing to do. A little too long for me because, you know, I eventually went to New York and it just seemed to go on forever, and I had to just, they asked me to renew the contract for another year at the end of that year's run, and I just couldn't face it anymore. It was just too intense to do it, you know. All those evenings a week, plus I'd foolishly accepted matinees as well, which means, I mean, it was insane. But after that, I was offered such rubbish, and it was all these revival musical things, Pirates of Penzance, and oh hell, I mean, it just went on and on. Jekyll and Hyde, I was offered. Funnily enough, just this last year, I was offered Chicago to take over from whoever's doing it on Broadway at the moment, and it's stuff like that, you know. And I just don't have any interest in doing kind of traditional Broadway anyway. Though the reason I accepted The Elephant Man is that it was so unlike anything that was on Broadway at the time. I thought it was really something new.
I asked David if there was anything left on his professional bucket list, anything he aspired to do creatively that he might want to change. And I was pleased, especially in hindsight of how few years he would have left, that his answer was this.
I don't have any so-called professional ambitions whatsoever. I'm so much enjoying exactly what it is that I do now, which is writing exactly the way I want to write and recording with the people that I love very much, and having a good, you know, family life at home in New York. I'm just really happy that I'm just really happy with the way my writing's going. It's just so much part of my life now. I'm just so at home going into the studio's very near to where I live as well now, downtown in New York. So, you know, it's just a few steps over the road. I don't see, and going out on the road and doing my shows, having wonderful receptions to the shows, there's nothing I want to change. Nothing.
David Bowie, remembering him and his music. Rest in peace, David Bowie, and thank you for everything you gave us. I'm Tom Lounges for Midwest Beat, remembering the Thin White Duke, the chameleon of rock and roll. Thanks for listening.
could look to my eyes.